From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Maasai people of northern Kenya win $7 million from the British government. Some 500 Maasai herders have been killed or seriously injured from unexploded bombs left by the British Army. We'll continue our debate on how 90 Peruvian Indians have become the latest Jewish settlers in the West Bank. And as tens of thousands work towards a sustainable world in Johannesburg, we'll look at where President Bush was this past weekend in Oregon, met by 2,000 people protesting his new logging rules. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. delegation to the World Summit in Johannesburg tried to counter widespread criticism that the United States is backing away from the international fight against poverty and environmental destruction. At the U.S. delegation's first news conference, Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs Paula Dobrianski declared the U.S. is, quote, the world's leader in sustainable development. She then unveiled a package of development partnerships with private corporations and foundations. Under the largest proposal, the U.S. would commit over $900 million over 3 years to digging wells and providing other access to clean water and sanitation services in places like West Africa. But the Chicago Tribune reports U.S. representatives repeatedly dodge questions about how much of the money represents new commitments and how much is just being pulled from other projects. Officials eventually admitted that only $20 million of the close to $1 billion is new financing. Meanwhile, Mikhail Gorbachev's international environmental group, Green Cross, released a new plan at the Earth Summit, urging delegates to set up a $50 billion fund to promote solar energy. The group wants the money to come from subsidies already paid to coal, oil, gas, and nuclear energy. The World Bank estimates that those subsidies equal $210 billion a year, mostly in the form of direct financial aid, tax breaks, and loan guarantees. In an opinion piece in the London Guardian headlined, "The U.S. Must Play Its Part," German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder writes that the devastating floods in Europe and Asia are not just terrible forces of nature. He says they're glaring warning signals and that global warming has now become a reality for many people. He says that it has become clear in the aftermath of September 11th that security cannot be maintained by military and police action alone. He writes, "There can be no global security without an agenda for global equity." And an internal European Union-United States joint document obtained by the Council of Canadians reveals the World Summit for Sustainable Development is fast becoming a new round for an international trade agreement rather than a conference on how to face the environmental and social problems the world is facing. The partial document covers parts of the summit's plan of action and shows that the United States and the European Union intend to subjugate the Johannesburg Declaration to the rules of the World Trade Organization. According to Maud Barlow, national chair of the Council of Canadians, this is clear evidence of the hijacking of the Johannesburg by powerful corporate interests. And the U.S. is being accused of putting intense pressure on the United Nations, the European Union, and individual countries to support the export of genetically modified food crops to 6 African countries facing severe hunger in the coming months. Zambia's chief scientific advisor says if his country accepts the GM foods, a precedent will be set undermining its legal and democratic systems. More than 150 people from the biotech industry are in Johannesburg. Monsanto told the London Guardian it had been lobbying African ministers and government delegations. Environmental and justice groups have little access to the ministers and delegations and are trying to build alliances to oppose the planting of GM crops. A new report put out by the U.S. environmental group American Rivers says the rapid expansion of paved over and developed land in metropolitan areas has made already intense drought conditions even worse. Billions of gallons of water that used to seep into fields or grasslands now rushes off new roads, roofs, driveways, and parking lots, turning into polluted runoff. The authors of the report say local, state, and federal governments have a role to play in reversing the trend because a whole range of government spending, regulations, subsidies, taxes, and policies now stimulate sprawl by making development outside urban centers cheaper and easier than building within cities. And the London Guardian reports Greenpeace tracked down the former head of Union Carbide, Warren Anderson, outside his home on Long Island and served him with an arrest warrant. He faces murder charges in India for his role in the death of over 14,000 following a 1984 disaster at the Union Carbide pesticide plant in the city of Bhopal. It had earlier been reported Anderson's whereabouts were unknown. A court in Bhopal has asked for extradition proceedings to be started to bring Anderson to court, but the Indian government may be reluctant to press for the extradition because it might alienate the U.S. business community. Three Supreme Court justices urged the court Wednesday to reconsider allowing juveniles to be sentenced to death. The call came in an unusual dissent from an order declining to stay the execution of Texas death row prisoner Toronto Patterson. Patterson was put to death late Wednesday for a crime he was convicted of committing when he was 17 years old. Justices John Paul Stevens, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer were the dissenters. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage says suspected members of Al-Qaeda who fled to Iraq are likely in an area of the country controlled by Kurdish groups, not President Saddam Hussein. The Washington Post reports his comments lend support to the Iraqi leadership's denial that they're playing host to Al-Qaeda fugitives, and it appears to undercut one argument used by War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to justify a possible attack on Iraq's ruler. Rumsfeld said last week that the Al-Qaeda members must be in Iraq with the assent of the Baghdad government. Meanwhile, French President Jacques Chirac has joined the growing chorus of foreign critics of a U.S., quote, preemptive strike against Iraq, even as Vice President Cheney again brushed aside calls for delay as irresponsible. And Phil Reeves reports in the London Independent that the Israeli army used a shell packed with 3,000 darts in its attack on civilians in the Gaza Strip earlier this week. The shell killed four members of a single family. A fifth member is in a deep coma, suffering from brain damage, two severed arteries, and a shredded leg. Israelis regularly condemn Palestinian suicide bombers for packing their bombs with nuts and bolts to maximize Israeli civilian casualties. Meanwhile, the United Nations envoy to the Middle East said Thursday, Israeli restrictions have caused deeper and broader economic fallout in Palestinian territories than previously thought, with unemployment reaching 50% and poverty in the Gaza Strip at 70%. Mire yara janyara Mire yara janyara Mire yara janyara Mire yara janyara Mire bara janyara Ni mela dono bena se anage anaka iko amadele ka se ya dunyana Oh mire ora janyara mire bara janya Mire Oro Adama Yolamba here on Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. After half a century of suffering from unexploded munitions left by the British military, a group of nomadic herders in northern Kenya will receive $7 million from the British government. British Army has trained for more than half a century on grazing land used by the Maasai tribe. An estimated 500 Maasai herders from northern Kenya have been killed or seriously injured by ammunition left on the firing range. According to the London Guardian, almost all the deaths and injuries have occurred when children played with unexploded ordnance while herding cattle and goats near the firing range. The settlement was reached after a London-based law firm threatened a major lawsuit against the British government on behalf of over 200 herders. Yesterday, I spoke with James Lagai, who's president of Usiligi, the human rights organization in Kenya, which helped the Maasai people to win the settlement. The word Usiligi means hope. I talked to him in northern Kenya and asked him for his reaction to the settlement.
I feel good that the Ministry of Defense at last decided to settle the case with the claimants who have suffered for a long time due to injuries they sustained as a result of an exploded ordnance left behind in the training areas where these pastoralists also grazed their livestock.
Can you describe the injuries that people sustained as a result of these unexploded munitions?
Many people sustained different types of injuries with different levels of severities. Some of them have lost limbs, others have lost their eyes, and many of them actually have died, and most of these are children.
Can you describe exactly what happens, how they injured people?
The armies have for a long time, for over 50 years, have been training in the northern part of Kenya, and in these ranges, pastoralists wander around herding their livestock, and they come across these ordinances, and without knowing, most of them being children who herd in this region, they come across these ordinances. Some of them look very nice. They start playing about them, and as a result, they explode. Others have been trampled by livestock, and then they explode, and people who are herding are hurt. And others have literally just accidentally stepped on them, and then they get injured. And there are actually no clear warnings to be able to keep off the people from those areas. At the same time, the armies just train in the open without restricting themselves to areas that there are no people. So that is how they came about to be injured.
This has been going on for more than half a century, more than 50 years. How did you finally get the British government to compensate the different communities?
This is purely an initiative of my organization, Usiligi, because most of them are illiterate. Most of them do not know even their rights. Most of them are pastoralists who have not had a chance even to know how these armies train. And they have been seeing like these armies are actually more powerful to them, and they've been fearing them. Until Usiligi been able to conduct a human rights training we train the human rights advocacy people, resource persons, the community, who have been able to train the community of their rights. And gradually they came to realize that actually the armies have caused them a lot of untold suffering. And as a result, we were able to bring out the case to the media, to the world. And we have actually, until we identify the law firm in UK, Lee and Day, to be able to file the case against the British government.
One last question, and that is, what else is your organization? What else is Usiligi working on?
Usiligi basically, as I said, is working on the areas of human rights advocacy and also development areas, to be able to empower these Maasai communities both economically and also socially, to be able to to take part in development issues. We're working in the areas of education, primary health care, areas of livestock improvement, to be able to actually empower these communities in all other aspects. So these are communities that have been marginalized for a long time. It's also the same community that has signed a land agreement, that lost the land to the British colonial government. And since then, after losing their land, then that is the beginning of their problems. They have nowhere to move to. These are persons, they're living in the remote parts of Kenya, in the very semi-arid areas, that they cannot even farm. The only other way to live is through livestock. But then now there is no land for herding. So basically, Osiligi is undertaking that to be able to provide alternatives, to be able also to lobby for the land to get back, the land that they lost to the British colonial government, that went to other people, that are still owned by multinational white farmers in Kenya, and it is still like a problem.
James Lagai with Osiligi, a northern Kenyan human rights aid and development organization working to empower the Maasai people. Again, the community that he works with has just won $7 million from the British government for 500 Maasai herders who've been killed or seriously injured from unexploded bombs left by the British Army. We go across now to London and are joined by Martin Day, the lawyer that prosecuted the British government. He's with Lay, Day and Company. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
How did you accomplish this?
Well, we were first approached by Osiligi back in March of last year, and to be frank, I was absolutely amazed that this issue had been around for so long and nobody had heard about it. And when talking to my colleagues and friends over here in London, they were similarly surprised. And it was really by, I think that once we had first brought the issue to the attention, not just the MOD, but to the wider world, and through the media, I think the British Army clearly realized that it had been caught with its pants down and were relatively quick to actually resolve this issue.
And so what exactly happens now? How will the transfer of money take place?
Well, the deal is, as you rightly say, that the amount is roughly $7 million US dollars. And what we've been working through is to what exactly each one of them would be entitled to within that amount. And for most of them, because the Kenyan economy is relatively poor, when you translate that into Kenyan shillings, it is a lot of money. And certainly all of them that we have seen, we've seen about 90% of all the claimants already, and absolutely every single one of them has been happy with the deal. The process now is to ensure that they get their money speedily, and at the same time that for a community so unused to money, bank accounts, interest, investments, and the rest, that we help as much as we possibly can do to ensure that they use the money wisely, whilst obviously in the end the decision for each is for each and every one of them.
What do you mean, use the money wisely?
Well, clearly for a community where money has, you know, for them $100 would be a massive amount of money, suddenly to reach, to receive tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, is a massive change. And in a community and a society where there's quite a lot of corruption, where there's a lot of perhaps shady people around in terms of the use of money, we are trying our best to ensure that they're educated into the use of things like bank accounts, which virtually none of them have ever had a bank account in their lives. So in terms of the use of money, to ensure that the money is invested and that they can, that they'll have the money long term and it won't suddenly all disappear at the drop of a hat.
Mm. Are you going to help Osiligi, as James Lagai says, they are taking on their next issue, which is dealing with the return of the land by British colonists and other foreigners who own roughly 60% of the land in Laikipia province, while in the same region there are some 30,000 Maasai people. and that 60% is owned by perhaps a couple hundred white ranchers and corporations.
Well, Osiligi raised this with us when we first went over there last year, and we felt at the time that the sense was to try and resolve the compensation issue immediately, because there were so many people in absolutely desperate straits without arms, legs, very seriously injured. Now we've reached a point where that is almost at an end, is almost resolved. We've agreed with Osiligi that this issue of the land will be one which we will quickly turn to. It's a more complicated issue legally, but is one that we hope that we will be able to assist them with and try and reach some sort of sensible and reasonable accommodation.
Martin Day, human rights lawyer from London. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, part two of our debate on how 90 Peruvian Indians have become the latest Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Stay with us.
To the break it down. Well, I'm not a Muslim, but I read the final curve, because the thinnest page is there, but something for us all. And I'm not professional, but I love basketball. Speaking of the sneakers, they echo into her. But if I don't have enemies, I'm not doing my job. When I'm at the white curve, but I never be throwing it out. People criticize me, but I know it's not the end. I try to kick the truth, not just to make friends. But hey, diddle, diddle to the people in the middle. We got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. Got the kids off the rumming, drum up the rumming. The people all humming and the vibe was loving. Hey, diddle, diddle to the people in the middle. Say we got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. We got the kids off the rumming, the drum up the rumming. The people all humming and the vibe was loving. Sing on and on. Break it down, sing on and on. Break it down. Well, I'm not a jerk, although sometimes I act like one. And I'm steady serious about us having fun. I go many places, but I know I'm not with you. I'm not a sucker, even though I'm stuck on you.
Michael Franti, People in the Middle. And Michael will be at the Golden Gate Park on September 7th with hundreds of nonprofit groups and other spoken word and musicians who will be there observing 9/11 and talking about peace. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday on the program, we heard a story about how 90 Peruvian Indians have become the latest Jewish settlers. Israeli journalist Neri Livne wrote in an article in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that on the order of the chief rabbi of Israel, Israel Mar Lau, a delegation of rabbis traveled to Peru. And according to Haaretz, the rabbis converted about 90 Peruvian Indians to Judaism. They converted only those who said they were willing to emigrate to Israel immediately, according to the paper. Upon arrival in Israel, the 90 new immigrants were taken straight from the airport to settlements in the West Bank. In the article, it says Nachson Ben Chaim, formerly Pedro Mendoza, says he's not bothered by the fact that he was sent to a settlement. He's also been effectively recruited to a particular political group. He told the Haaretz, "We knew we were coming to a place that is called territories because people we know immigrated earlier and are living in the settlements and the territories, but I have no problem with that because I do not consider the territories to be occupied territories. You cannot conquer what has in any case belonged to you since the time of the patriarch Abraham." Ben Chaim says that after he finishes the Hebrew course, he may join the army, quote, "because I wasn't in the army in Peru, and that is something I lack, and also because I want to defend the country, and if there is no choice, I will kill Arabs. But I am sure that Jews will kill Arabs only for self-defense and justice, but Arabs do it because they like to kill." The article goes on to say that he bases his belief on his scientific view of Judaism. Quote, "The Arab has the instinct of murder and killing like all Gentiles, and only Jews do not have that instinct. That is a genetic fact," unquote. Well, we began a discussion about this story yesterday with Brian Schwartz, who is president of an organization called Scattered Among the Nations. We are also joined on the phone by our two other guests, Michael Tarazi, who is legal advisor to the PLO, and Jessica Montel, who is executive director of B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. Brian Schwartz yesterday raised the fund. Brian Schwartz raised the funds that made it possible for the Peruvians to go to Israel. And to reintroduce our listeners and viewers to this story, Brian, can you talk about why the Peruvian Indians were brought to Israel after conversion to the occupied territories?
I could tell you a story about Pedro Nachshon Mendoza, the person who's Mr. Ben Chaim now with his new name. Pedro, I visited him in his home in Peru. He was a very religious person, had been practicing Judaism very devoutly for over a decade with his family. He lived in a mud brick home with a corrugated iron roof. They had a kosher kitchen in their home and some tapes of some Israeli music, but very few other possessions. He showed me the ram's horn that he made, which as a shofar, which is a Jewish ceremonial object. He showed me some of the other things that he'd made, a mezuzah, which is a small box that he made that goes on the door of a doorpost of a Jewish home. And Mr. Mendoza, because he was very religious in Peru, he would not work on the Jewish Sabbath or the Jewish holidays. It's one of the commandments of the Jewish religion not to work on those days, and couldn't find any decent work where they would allow him not to, any decent job where they'd allow him not to to work on those days. So he had to drive a cab for a living, because it was the only job that gave him any kind of scheduling flexibility. And several times driving a cab in Trujillo, Peru, he'd had a gun held to his head. At one point, the other individual cocked the trigger and was about to kill him. And Pedro begged for his life and was fortunately spared. But these are the kinds of things that he had to do in order to practice his religion in Peru. So for him, going to Israel is a great redemption. Mrs. Livne, in her article, unfortunately, emphasizes the fact, and as did your other guest yesterday, that where he's living is in the West Bank, about 8 miles, I guess, or so from Jerusalem. But to me, what's really important is the fact that Israel is, despite the fact that it's involved in a very serious war for its survival, Israel is continuing to make efforts to absorb people who seek religious freedom. That was the mission of the state when it was created, was to be a homeland, a place for the Jewish people where they could be safe and practice Judaism safely. It continues to be that for people like Pedro Mendoza.
Jessica Montel, Executive Director of B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. Your organization has just released a report called Land Grab, Israeli Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Your response to Brian Schwartz?
Well, obviously I have no problem with anyone who feels him or herself to be Jewish to be recognized as such. I wish Israel's Chief Rabbinate would act in a similarly tolerant manner towards all those who consider themselves to be Jewish around the world. The issue for us as a human rights organization dealing with the occupied territories is the fact that these people have been settled in what is not the state of Israel, but what is territory occupied in settlements that have been established contrary to international humanitarian law. Those settlements result in a wide range of human rights violations against Palestinians, from discriminatory access to water and land, to increasing impoverishment of Palestinian communities because of the lack of land to develop housing, agriculture, infrastructure, to the issue of freedom of movement, seemingly unconnected, and yet those Palestinians living close to Jewish settlements are the ones who face the most severe restrictions on their movement. I would also add that the human rights of settlers is being compromised in that Israel is putting all these resources into the occupied territories to encourage people who will live there primarily for financial reasons. There's a very large population who live in the settlements because it has been made financially worthwhile to them. And these people are now endangered. It's not clear to me that Peruvian Jews now living in the occupied territories are physically more safe where they are now than they were in Peru because of the attacks by Palestinians, obviously taking place both inside Israel but at an even greater rate in the occupied territories. And those Israelis that would like to leave the occupied territories and move back to Israel are prevented from doing so, receive no services from the government, no support from the government. So in effect, the government is holding them there as hostages, as bargaining chips, and by doing so, violating the human rights both of Israelis and of Palestinians.
Michael Tarazi, legal advisor to the PLO, do you see a population transfer beginning here?
Well, it began in 1967 when Israel established its first settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, most notably then in East Jerusalem. I think what's happening here and what needs to be said very clearly is that these Peruvians are being used as political pawns in a master demographic game. Israel needs to populate, I should say, the extreme right wing in Israel, which apparently has been in power now under Sharon and really under most of the government since 1967. The primary motivation is to colonize the occupied Palestinian territories with as many Jews or as many people who call themselves Jews as possible in order to maximize the Jewish presence while minimizing the Palestinian presence in order to eventually make a claim that we can never give back the occupied Palestinian territories to the Palestinians and have a Palestinian state. I think it's unfortunate because these Peruvians, if indeed they were facing persecution for their beliefs, as Mr. Schwartz suggests, would be much safer, of course, inside Israel proper. Instead, they are sent as political pawns into the heart of occupied Palestinian territory where there is the most conflict. So I think it's rather strange to say that they're fleeing persecution and only make them in a situation that's more dangerous than what they left in the past. That's because it's not about persecution. It's not about saving Jews from the exile. It's about colonizing Palestinian territory and making it impossible to reach a peaceful agreement with the Palestinians based on two states.
Ryan Schwartz of Scattered Among the Nations, your response.
I realize that my fellow guests on the program have a particular agenda that they're trying to espouse, and so that it's important for them to try to make this once again into another issue and revisit the litany of Palestinian woes in the West Bank, none of which I can sit here and dispute with as much. I'm not the Israeli State Department or government representative here. The problem is that that's not the issue. This has nothing to do with the conversion of the Inca Jews has nothing to do with a power grab, has nothing to do with really the West Bank. They are in the West Bank. I think when people immigrate to America or to other countries, they also tend to go to the neighborhoods that are not as desirable, that are cheaper, and naturally it's cheaper, you know, to get housing in the West Bank because people don't want to go there because it's not as safe. Well, what they do have now in Israel
is it also because the Israeli government is subsidizing it particularly heavily?
Yes, because it's because otherwise, yeah, that's true. Listen, if Israel had opted to put these people in somewhere else, in the Negev, in some other part of Israel, I would have been ecstatic. I don't want to give you the impression that I was somehow involved with the decision that they would be put into the West Bank, but I don't think that helps make anybody's point. Because the real issue here is, and what I think should be focused on is a really positive and beautiful story. I know that's less appealing to the other guests, but it's a very positive and beautiful story about how Israel has gone and helped a group of Inca people who embrace Judaism to realize their dream of living in a place not just where they have where their physical security may still be difficult on a day-to-day basis, but where they have the security of knowing that they can seek a Jewish education, where they can be with teachers. It's simply not true that these people were just sort of swept up like a group of random people in some other continent and brought over to colonize a place. It's not true at all. These are people who struggled for decades to gain any kind of recognition. And even now, when these rabbis went over to Peru, I want you to know they only converted less than half of the Peruvians there who wanted to be converted to Judaism, who actively sought conversion. Israel turned them down, did not let them immigrate, because they didn't feel that their level of Jewishness was sufficient. So, I think Israel's making it too difficult for people
really
to come.
I really need to jump in on this, Amy, if I might. I really need to point out
Michael Tarazi, legal advisor to the PLO.
as you pointed out earlier in the article in Haaretz, the only those who said they'd be willing to move to Israel were allowed to convert. If you said that you did not want to move to Israel, and I would hazard to guess if you said you did not want to move to the occupied Palestinian territories, you probably would not have been allowed to convert.
It's just not true. I mean, I was involved with the process, so I can tell you that what you're saying is not a fact. The fact is that they weren't told at all which part of Israel they were going to when they converted. So that was not even an issue.
They didn't go to Israel, Brian. They went to the occupied Palestinian territories. That's not Israel.
Okay. Well, you call it what you want to call it. I'll call it the West Bank. They didn't know that was where they were going to be put. They converted because they wanted to become Jewish. So
right.
Why were
they put there? Of all the places in Israel, why were they put in occupied Palestinian territories? Why weren't they put somewhere else? There's plenty of space inside Israel. Why do you think of all?
Is there? I don't know. Is that true?
You have the entire Negev. Ask Jessica.
Have you been to the Negev? It's dry.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not a very developed place.
It's not a problem finding absorption for 90 Peruvian Jews. It's clear that if Israel had wanted to absorb them inside Israel, they could have absorbed them inside Israel. Israel invests tremendous financial resources in settling Jews in the occupied territories, whether that's immigrants, and these are not the only group of immigrants who have gone straight from the airport to the occupied territories, at a time when Israel's economy is in an extremely difficult situation and financial resources are being cut across the board. It continues to be the case that Israel invests disproportionate resources in kindergartens, public transportation, income benefits, welfare payments to settlers in the occupied territory.
Right, and okay.
Jessica Montel, let me ask Jessica Montel this question from B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, about the issue of people being brought in, Jews being brought in from around the world. Is there an organized program where they're brought into the occupied territories? And are there other places, could you name other countries outside of Peru, where they're then brought to the West Bank?
The Jewish Agency has organized immigrations of Jews from Latin America when there was the economic crisis in Argentina and other Latin American countries, from former Soviet Union, Jews who have gone directly to the occupied territories. So obviously the story of Jews who are finally allowed to celebrate their and observe their religion freely, I agree with Brian, is a positive story. The fact that the chief rabbinate is not discriminating on the basis of, color or race and is recognizing these people as Jews, obviously that's a positive story, but it's not the only story here.
And the other part of the story, if I might jump in.
Michael Tarazi of Legal Advisor PLO.
As beautiful as it might be that Israel has been this Jewish homeland and can now save persecuted Incan Jews, Peruvians, there's another ugly side to that, which is that Christian and Muslim Palestinians, of course, who originate from here, have absolutely no right to return to their homes inside Israel. 75% of the Christian and Muslim population were made refugees in 1948 and thereafter. 400 villages were destroyed in order to make sure they had nothing to return to. So I find it rather remarkable that an Incan from Peru who adopted Judaism and is settled in the heart of the West Bank has more rights than a Christian or Muslim who actually originates from here to actually return. It's a very ugly side of that very beautiful story.
Brian Schwartz.
Yeah, again, unfortunately, I think Mr. Tarazi's information is pretty misleading. I think that the other Arab states encouraged the Arabs who were in 1948 to leave that area because they said they assured them that they would be conquering that piece of land and give them the entire piece of land after they destroyed the state when it was created. At that same time, 600,000 Jews were forced or felt compelled to leave the Arab countries that they lived in around there because of escalated persecution. This is in 1948, which was roughly the same number of Palestinians who chose to leave Israel. Many Palestinians, however, stayed in Israel, and there are many Israeli Arabs today who vote, who are members of parliament. Israel is a democracy. Israel continues to elect these governments, which I may or may not favor, but they elect these governments because people are genuinely concerned about their security because they have bombs blowing up on their school buses on a fairly regular basis. So I just think that this unfortunate one-sided portrayal, which again has very little to do with this very positive and beautiful, compelling story about groups of people around the world who continue to find hope in the state of Israel, despite the incredibly difficult security situation, it remains a place where people can feel redeemed
But only people of a certain religion. Christians
Michael
Turan. It's a Jewish state, Mr.
Turan.
It is a Jewish state. It's a very small Jewish state.
Exactly right, Brian. A Jewish state means the right to discriminate against Christians and Muslims. And I think we need to be very open about that. Because I think it would be really beautiful if Christian and Muslim refugees were allowed to return to their homes, too, and find redemption in Israel. But
well,
they're not because of their religion.
Well,
it might be beautiful for these Incans, it's very ugly for the Palestinians.
The dozen or more Arab states surrounding Israel, I think, give plenty of opportunities.
We're not from there. Mr.
Right.
Schwartz, I'm from Palestine.
Right.
I'm not from Lebanon or Jordan.
Sure. Well, as you know, the United States government, and I certainly, as a human being, would strongly support at some point the creation of a Palestinian state. But
why can't we return to Israel if that's where we're from? Because we're Christians and Muslims. Just say it. This is a highly discriminatory practice. It's been going on for 55 years, and it's the very cause of what's been going on here now over the last 2 years in the uprising. We have to understand the fundamental discrimination that Israel imposes on the Christian and Muslim population. So while we talk about the beautiful Incan Jews who come all the way from South America to settle Palestinian territory in the West Bank, let us also talk about the fact that there are millions of Christian and Muslim Palestinian refugees who have not had that right for 55 years.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us for the second part of our discussion, debate around the Peruvian indigenous people who were brought to Israel by the Israeli rabbinate and settled in the West Bank. Michael Tarazi has been our guest, legal advisor to the PLO. Brian Schwartz, president of Scattered Among the Nations, responsible for raising the funds that made it possible for the Peruvians to become the latest settlers in Israel. And Jessica Montel, executive director of B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. When we come back, we're going to Portland, Oregon. There was not much coverage of a major protest last week where police used tear gas and rubber bullets against close to 2,000 people who were protesting President Bush's visit. Stay with us.
America, indeed the world, is under attack from a sinister force led by a boy. The world's most powerful boy, Owl Boy.
Dear Daddy. Dear Daddy.
The world's most powerful boy, a picture of George Bush on the cover. This was a CD that was given to me on my trip to Northern California last weekend to Hopland, to Soul Fest. It's by Patriotica. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As tens of thousands in Johannesburg are working to make a sustainable world, we turn now to Portland, Oregon, where over 1,000 people met President Bush last weekend to protest his environmental policies as well as his so-called war on terror. They, in turn, were greeted by hundreds of police, including many in full riot gear, some even wearing black bandanas over their faces, the police, that is. Despite peaceful protests, the police declared a state of emergency and threatened to arrest anyone who would not disperse. But then the police began shooting people with rubber bullets and pepper spray. Children were among the victims of the attack, including a 10-month-old baby. Before we go to a debate over the issue of Bush's logging policies, we're joined by Don Jogan, who is a father, a carpenter, and was protesting Bush's visit last weekend. We didn't hear very much about this protest. Don, can you tell us what happened and why you were outside on that day?
Well, it was an enormous protest. The national media got it completely wrong. There were, I would say, over 2,000 people there, possibly even more than that. And the issues ranged from environmental policies to welfare reform to the war on terrorism, to Middle East policy in general. Just about everybody was out there. My family is concerned with civil rights and civil liberties issues, so we were out there for that, but we were mainly out there to show our support for all the different activists working on issues that that we agree with. The major part of the police action took place away from us. We were with the families. We were in the back of the crowd. There is wonderful video shot by people in the crowd of the major police rubber bullet and tear gas attack that should be making its way, hopefully, to an outlet somewhere that people can see it. What happened to us was a little bit different, actually. We had left the protest with a group of maybe 150 people with a drumming marching band, and we're actually blocks and blocks from the hotel where Bush was. The police led the crowd into an intersection and closed off all four exits and began pepper spraying from opposite of where we were with our children. We asked the police closest to us if we could exit through the lines, and they informed us that the exit was on the other side where they were already pepper spraying. We asked again, saying we couldn't go that way, and an officer drew out his can and pepper sprayed myself, my 3-year-old, and my wife and our 10-month-old directly from point-blank range. We were refused to go through the lines to seek help for about maybe 10 minutes. They finally led us through the lines, and wonderful people from a health group called the Black Cross Health Collective helped us on the scene until we could get in a car and get to the emergency room.
How are your children and your wife?
You know, physically, the effects of the pepper spray seem to wear off. Everybody's pretty freaked out. You know, it was a pretty direct assault, you know, just from a personal point of view, and upon, you know, later reflection is a very scary assault from a political point of view.
Alan Graf is also with us, chair of policy for the Portland chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. You just held a news conference about the response of the police. How would you characterize it overall?
Inhumane and militaristic. It was not, it didn't look to me like police, it looked more like military to me. And I've lived in Central America for years. I lived in Guatemala down there, and it really reminded me of living in Guatemala. It was very third world-esque, the way the police treated the protesters. They didn't treat them like humans. They treated them like cattle, basically, and it was despicable.
I said some were wearing black bandanas over their faces, not describing the protesters, the police?
Right. It's really amazing. You know, the cops always get uptight about, you know, the so-called anarchists with their black bandanas. And there they were with black bandanas over their faces, and I agree with Don, too. There was probably about 2,000 to 3,000 folks out there. It was one of the more peaceful demonstrations I've ever seen. As a matter of fact, the people were so well-behaved that when they set up the barricades, the airspace above the barricades wasn't even penetrated by the protesters. Nobody even stuck their hand over it, kind of like, you know, mimes in front and behind the barricades where they wouldn't even touch the barricade. And so it was the assault on the protesters was totally unprovoked and felt to me very mean-spirited and political. I think really, you know, we've actually had a pretty good relationship with the cops for the last 2 years in terms of demonstrations because they lost it a couple of May Days ago and we had a bunch of meetings and they backed down considerably. And this was a re-escalation of tactics against political dissent that I think actually reflects upon who they were protecting.
Don Jogan, why were you there? Why was your family out protesting?
Pardon me?
Why was your family protesting?
We were there as a family to support, you know, generally to support other groups that were more actively working on issues. You know, we don't have a lot of time to be actively committed and involved.
Those issues being what?
Oh, well, one of my personal things is the USA Patriot Act. I find the erosion of civil liberties under Ashcroft to be just appalling. And, you know, this talk of people, you know, detaining people without due process and things like that really drives me crazy.
Don Jogan and Alan Graf of National Lawyers go, we're going to turn now to another of the issues that were being raised by the people in the streets as well as others. President Bush was in Portland to announce a relaxation of federal logging regulations, which he claims is necessary to reduce the threat of forest fires. The Healthy Forest Initiative calls for reduced protection of the nation's old growth forests and increased thinning of federally protected forests. But many scientists and environmentalists say his plan has more to do with serving the timber industry than with saving forests. At the protest, one protester held a sign reading, "More forest, less Bush." Well, we're joined right now by Timothy Inglesby, director of the Western Foreign Ecology Center of the American Lands Alliance, which is campaigning with firefighters in Oregon to stop Bush's initiative in Congress. Chris West also joins us, vice president of the American Forest Resource Council, which represents 80 landowners and forest product manufacturers in 12 Western states. Chris West of the American Forest Resource Council, can you tell us why you support President Bush's federal logging regulations, the relaxation of them?
Well, actually, Amy, I would have to say that your intro was a little off the mark here. In anybody that's read the president's initiative, has nothing to do with old growth logging. It has everything to do with reducing the risk of catastrophic wildfire. And logging can play a role in that. Scientists around the country for years have been saying that we need to reduce the smaller trees that are clogging our forests because of past forest practices and fire suppression. And this is not an old growth issue. The environmental community is trying to make it an old growth issue because that's where they know they can raise money and create controversy. But the simple fact is we're burning 5, 6, 10 million acres every several years in catastrophic events, which is environmentally destructive. And if we can reduce that damage done to the environment and wildlife habitat, municipal watersheds, by thinning the forest from below, we ought to be doing that. And what the president's proposing is just federal initiative that follows what the Western Governors Association over the last several years in a bipartisan group that included environmentalists, community leaders, and the timber industry came up with. So this is nothing new. It's just implementing what everybody knows we need to do to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire.
Timothy Inglesby?
Yes.
Director of the Fire Western Fire Ecology Center. You're working with firefighters?
Yes. Been advocating on behalf of firefighter safety for a number of years. And I'd have to say that this always happens. Forest management policies are crafted in Washington, D.C. without ever consulting forest workers or firefighters. No one ever talks to them. So it's always these top-down initiatives that basically serve the interest of corporations, you know, over communities. And I have to say that it's a bit of a distortion to say that this that Bush's policy conforms to the Western Governor Association's 10-year comprehensive strategy. I myself was appointed by Oregon Governor Kitzhaber to be on the fire core team of consultants working on the Western Governor Association's plan, and this Bush's policy is nothing like that plan.
I would have to ask Tim,
Chris West,
where is it not consistent? Because all Bush's initiative talks about is increasing thinning and prescribed fire to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfires effects on communities, watersheds, and wildlife habitat. And that's exactly what the 10-year strategy does. And if we don't have activities occur on the ground, we're going to continue to have these catastrophic events that are so destructive.
Timothy Inglesby.
Yeah, the Western Governors Association plan says nothing about suspending environmental protection laws. It says nothing about ending citizen rights to appeal bad projects. It says nothing really about giving away trees for free in order to entice timber companies to cart away the logging slash. It says nothing of that sort. But what the real issue is, what is the difference between thinning versus logging? And that's where the issue really boils down to. And to say that the Bush's plan is nothing, won't involve old growth logging, it really depends on what is your definition of old growth. And the industry has a very narrow definition of old growth. Basically, the oldest trees, and there's very few left of those. The real issue is mature and old growth trees, saw grade trees, and trees above 12 inches in diameter or more are not really the fire hazard we have to prioritize. What we have to prioritize are those small diameter trees, the brush, the old logging slash that's just covering the ground, and no one's ever really dealt with those. Those are what fuel a fire.
And I would agree 100% that it's the smaller trees, and that's what the Healthy Forest Initiative is all about. And what we have here is an environmental community that is just totally freaked out about the possibility that somebody may utilize this wood and produce a product that consumers use every day. My mills, the members of my association that have sawmills, are producing products out of 5- and 6-inch material. And 12-inch material is great stuff. And the problem continues to be that people want to make this out to be a bigger issue than it is. And if we don't reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire, we're going to continue to burn, like we did this summer, hundreds of thousands of acres of old-growth habitat that's critical to the spotted owl, to salmon, to the marbled murrelet, like we did on the Biscuit Fire in southern Oregon. And if we don't reduce the risk of these fires, we're going to continue to do that. If we can remove this material and utilize some of it to produce products and put people to work, we should be doing that because it reduces the cost to the federal government.
Timothy Inglesby, I'm looking at the Seattle Post Intelligencer of today, which says the Bush administration is reviewing an environmental law both reviled and praised because it sometimes requires lengthy studies before loggers clear-cut a hillside or developers start to dig. White House officials say they want to, quote, modernize this 32-year-old law, which they blame for bureaucratic gridlock. Environmentalists fear it's a move to roll back crucial protections. Your response?
Well, again, this is a long-standing right-wing agenda. You know, part of the wider context of rolling back citizen rights and freedoms. Let's just cut the public out of being informed participants in public lands management. The issue isn't that it takes so long to analyze the impacts. We pretty much know what are the ecological effects of extracting big old trees. They're negative. The issue is that agencies just don't want to tell the public the truth about these environmental impacts. And the issue is they keep trying to ram controversial projects down the public's throat. And so it will take some lengthy, it will lengthen the time to get these projects because there's righteous citizen resistance to them.
On that note, I have to thank you both for being with us as we come to the end of the program. Timothy Inglesby, director of the Western Fire Ecology Center, the American Lands Office in Eugene, Oregon, and Chris West, vice president of the American Forest Resource Council, representing forest product manufacturers and 80 forest land owners in Portland, Oregon. And that does it for the program. If you'd like to go to our website, you can go to www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And Democracy Now! Will be joining WBAI and Pacifica Radio around the country in bringing special coverage on September 11th. We'll be doing a special 4-hour broadcast in the morning at the time the planes hit in New York, and then Pacifica will be going to WPFW in Washington, where another plane hit the Pentagon. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Chris Abrams, Femi Terry, Anna Noguera, San Tung, and I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Ticking time bombs.